Hello and welcome to Fantastic Fights, the podcast about a middle-aged man playing adventure game books out loud on the internet. That middle-aged man is me, Hieronymus J. Doom, and this episode sees us play book 56 in the long-running fighting fantasy series, Knights of Doom, written by Jonathan Green with internal illustrations by series regular Tony Huff, who also provided the cover illustration, which shows a grey monster sat on top of a red monster in some kind of dying forest. The grey monster looks quite angry, or maybe pleased, and has brought an axe with him to illustrate how angry he is. But honestly, he's an amateur in the anger stakes compared to the weird bull demon thing he's riding. That is a furious monster right there, and fair play to it, honestly. I'd be annoyed if someone was riding on my back as well. I'd describe the font used for the title of Knights of Doom on the front page as fairly insipid compared to some that we've seen recently. Honestly, it's just a bunch of letters. Pulling back the curtain for a moment, I'm starting this podcast on the very same day that I posted the last one. I have to go away and visit family later in the month, so I need to get this squared away earlier than usual. Does mean that I get to spend the rest of the month writing, so that's nice. It does mean there's no update on the gamebook I was supposed to spend this week finishing, but I'm going to take my laptop up while I'm in Yorkshire and turn it into a working holiday, and I'll be posting updates on my Patreon page at patreon.com/hjdoom to keep you abreast of any developments. So without any further ado, let's take a look at the rules of Knights of Doom. Okay, we've got a certain amount to get through here. In this adventure, rather than playing the usual professional adventurer, we are playing a Templar Knight of Telak, very much a paladin kind of protagonist, and that comes with changes to the rules. Skill, stamina, and luck are all present and correct, as we would expect, but you also get an honour score, which begins at 6. This represents your knightly virtue and unselfishness. It's the sort of thing that makes sense to include, though I do always have a few reservations about morality systems, since they tend to make certain choices much less likely, and a choice you never actually make isn't particularly going to impact the story. It's all a question of how it actually plays out, of course, and I'm looking forward to finding out. My knight has a skill of 10, a stamina of 18, and a luck of 7. Not great, but we'll see how we get on. Alongside this, we get to choose 4 skills from a list of 9. 5 skills are warrior skills, and 4 skills are priest skills, and you have to pick at least one from each category. I love a skill system, and I really like the idea that you can create a character who leans more to the clerical end of the knightly spectrum, or more to the military end of the knightly spectrum. Very quickly, the warrior skills are battle tactics, which lets you lead people in battle, ride, which makes you an expert horseman, target, that lets you use ranged weapons, tracking, which is tracking, and weapons, which gives you expertise in a second weapon on top of your sword knowledge. The priest skills are arcane lore, which reflects knowledge of myths, legends, and other things. Banish spirits lets you free spirits by the power of your faith. Commune lets you sense psychic and magical vibrations, and Holy Strike allows you to drain power from demonic entities. I think I fancy playing a knight who is more in the priestly line, so I've chosen tracking as my obligatory warrior skill, and then I've chosen Banish Spirits, Commune, and Holy Strike for that full warrior monk templar vibe. We're also told we have to track time, which is always a source of unbridled joy. At least it's tracking it by day rather than by random time units. Once again, we will see how this pans out in practice. Finally, there's some messing about with our equipment. Instead of the ubiquitous leather armour, we get a full set of chainmail, and we get given a magical sword that can hit demons and the like, which is a nice touch. We don't have any ready cash on hand, typical of the upper classes, and we don't have any provisions, which is a shame, but we do have a horse called Firemane. Aside from being a horse and doing horse stuff, Firemane allows us to carry a second weapon, which the author has slightly arbitrarily decided we can't do without a horse. We can only switch weapons when we have access to Firemane, and honestly, it seems like a lot of faff compared to telling us we can only have one weapon at a time. It's the sort of thing I would forget about immediately in a tabletop game, and there's honestly little chance of remembering it here, though I will do my very best. Possibly this is just me objecting to being beholden to a horse, but hopefully it's not going to crop up. I think that's everything. Without further ado, let's play Knights of Doom. Background.
The kingdom is sick and I am mortally ill.
Gasps of dismay come from the crowd. The leaders of all the major religious and secular orders of Ruddlestone are assembled here in the hall that is bedecked with the banners of those orders. You are standing in front of the king's ornately carved oak throne. You are suddenly aware how weak and tired King Ranor looks. Having regained his breath, the king speaks again.
My physicians tell me that I am suffering from no ordinary illness and that there is only one cure. The land and the king are one, and because there is chaos in the land, I am dying. If the kingdom is to survive, then the source of this disruption must be destroyed, for without a true king, the land itself will die.
Will it, though? Will it actually? Far be it from me to say that King Ranor has just come down with a dose of man flu and extrapolated it out to be an existential threat to the existence of the kingdom, but it's the sort of thing I can imagine happening.
What is the source of this chaos?
You ask. Aranidus, the court wizard and advisor to the king, answers your question.
Several weeks ago, during a terrible storm over Banarask Hills, a gateway opened between our world and the spirit planes, centred upon the ruins of the fortress of Caer Skarl. My fellow sorcerers and I detected the disturbance it was causing on the magical ether, and for kilometres around people saw a great swirling vortex form amidst the boiling storm clouds. Eyewitness accounts say that while the portal remained open, terrible screaming spirits could be seen flying across the night sky. It was a truly terrifying spectacle to behold. However, before the vortex closed again, something else was detected escaping from the ethereal plane. Something of the utmost evil that exuded corruption. Recently, reports have been coming from the south concerning a band of dark warriors who are terrorizing the countryside and carrying banners that bear the motif of a metal gauntlet holding a black sword.
You gaze at the old wizard in horror.
Yes, he says gravely. The arms of the Chaos Knights of Caer Skarl.
So we are in absolute classic fighting fantasy territory with bizarre evil from the distant past and indeed another plane of existence popping up to harass the good folk of Ruddlestone and the somewhat anemic King Ranor. I mean, I'm quite done with this sort of thing on some level, but they keep going back to this particular well because it does sort of always work. Every Templar knows about that terrible period in Ruddlestone's history. 100 years ago, the king and head of your order at that time, Shivalras the Ninth, had a brother, Belgaroth, who was also one of the Knights of Telak. Belgaroth was consumed with jealousy for his brother and desired to be king himself. Although Shivalras was in truth a worthy monarch, Belgaroth considered him a weak king and thought that Ruddlestone should be ruled with an iron fist. As the years passed, Belgaroth spent more and more time away from the citadel at his own castle on the edge of the Banarask Hills. During that time, he became corrupted by his own hatred and jealousy, so that eventually he rejected Telak and turned to worshipping the dark gods of chaos, that they might grant him the power to destroy Shivalras. As part of his service to his dark masters, Belgaroth founded an order of chaos knights to lead his hordes of evil against the citadel. See, that's genuinely quite cool. I'm a big fan of dark reflections of knightly orders and things where you get that inversion of something good that partakes of some of the same qualities, but in a way that's twisted and evil. I mean, I guess kind of like the Sith in the Star Wars universe, being a sort of dark mirror of the Jedi. Again, it's storytelling 101, but it does sort of always work for me. However, Chivalrous's spies uncovered Belgaroth's plans, and so the crusade against Chaos began. The war raged on for several months, until the Knights of Telak at last stood before Belgaroth's castle, the fortress of Kaer Skarl, and besieged it. Within 2 weeks the battle was won, and the Chaos Knights were no more. From that time the ghost-haunted ruins of Kaer Skarl were left to the inhabitants of those wild lands.
Belgaroth must have returned from the lands of the dead and resurrected his Dark Order,
Arrendus continues.
His servants strive for disruption and confusion so that chaos may tighten its grip upon our world. There is talk of witchcraft in the north. The dead are rising from their graves, and there have been many dark portents seen across the land.
Strong 2025 energy to Ruddleston at this point.
There are even rumours that in places the ancient forest of Lean has begun to wither and die. If the land and the king are to be saved, this chaos must be stopped. The Knights of Kaer Skarl must be destroyed.
Addressing you directly, the king takes up the story.
My advisers tell me that a single skilled warrior would have a greater success in this quest than a large force, as a lone knight will be able to travel faster and will find it easier to penetrate the enemy's lines without being detected. We need to strike as quickly as possible, and to prepare an army would take several days.
Ah, yes. The traditionally feeble excuse as to why sending a single person is definitely the best plan, and an equally feeble rationale for why sending an army just isn't going to be possible.
You have been chosen to be that knight, for you are one of the greatest of all the knights of Telak. Your courage, your prowess in battle, and your command of mystic powers taught by the Order are known throughout the kingdom. You will accept the quest, of course.
Yes, my liege, you reply. If the kingdom is in danger, then I must do all I can to stop these Knights of Chaos. I don't know why I decided to characterise my character, who I have given the very heroic name Sir Slurpy Syrupsup to, as a grudging knight, but apparently that's the characterisation I'm going with.
Good,
says the king with a sigh of relief.
You must head for Kaer Skarl and try to stop this evil. This will also give us time to prepare a force were you to fail in your mission. However, I pray that you do not. Should Belgaroth seek revenge on the royal line of Chivalras, then all of Ruddleston may be doomed.
You bow to King Ranor and turn to leave the audience chamber. As you do so, the large double doors at the far end of the hall burst open and a chill gust of wind blows through the chamber. From beyond the open portal you can hear the clip-clop of a horse's hooves on the flagstone. The noise draws closer, until it sounds as if it was inside the hall, but you can see nothing. Then it stops, and at the same moment the temperature in the hall drops. As you watch, a phosphorescent green glow begins to appear in front of you. Something is materializing in the audience chamber. Something not of this world. So that's the introduction. Reasonably good. I mean, absolute bargain basement nonsense, but getting it done in 3.5 pages earns my undying gratitude, and finishing with a ghostly apparition is pretty cool. There is a picture of the ghostly apparition as well. A skeletal knight sat on a fairly ordinary horse that's glowing a bit. Yeah, it's a solid, decent bit of work, I would say. The phosphorescence rapidly increases in size, making a recognisable shape. Directly in front of you, a ghostly armoured knight forms, surrounded by an eerie green glow, and mounted on a phantom steed. Inside the helmet, the knight's face is that of a fleshless skull. its empty eye socket staring down at you. The ghost points at you with its sword, its jaw drops open, and the dead knight lets out a ghastly moan. Beware, mortals! Beware! Before you can react, the horse rears up on its hind legs and tries to crush you beneath its hooves. Test your luck! So my luck is only 7, and a 9 is a failure. So luck now 6. You try and throw yourself out of the path of the crushing hooves, but you are just too late. The horse hits you in the back, knocking you to the floor. Lose 3 stamina points. Stamina now 15. Ignoring you, the ghostly knight urges its mount towards the king, raising its weapon ready to strike. You must act quickly. Will you use the Banish Spirit skill if you have it? Use the Holy Strike skill if you have it, or attack the ghost? I will use the Banish skill, please. Hurriedly, you make the necessary arcane gestures to banish the ghost. The dead knight lets out a baleful shriek, and both it and its phantom mount fade away before your very eyes. Go team Banish Spirits. As the ghost is sent on its way to its final astral destination, it cries out, Beware, Belgoroth lives. Then it is gone. The king thanks you for delivering him from the spirit, but once you have recovered, he urges you to be on your way.
The dead knight was a portent, maybe, of what was, what is, or what is to come. Since Belgoroth himself has returned to our world, your mission becomes of the utmost urgency and importance. Equip yourself from the armory, but go with all haste.
Bidding the king and his council farewell, you leave the audience chamber and make for the citadel's ancient and much-renowned armory. Inside the vast cellar beneath the castle, Wern the armorer and his team of weaponsmiths, metallurgists, and engineers are busy making and repairing weapons for the Knights of Telak. Wern, a broad, well-built man, stripped to his waist and wearing a leather apron, puts down the tongs he has been using and leads you to a large door at one end of the armory. He unlocks it with a key selected from a large bunch hanging from his belt and leads you inside.
This is where we keep the most precious weapons. Some once belonged to the Crusaders and heroes of the past.
Looking around the vault, you see row upon row of racks, heavy with gleaming weapons and polished armour. With Wern's help, you pick out several weapons and pieces of armour that may be of use to you. From the list of items below, choose a maximum of 2 to take on your quest, then turn to the paragraphs listed by them to find out more about your choice. Remember, you can only use 1 weapon at a time, and carry another on your steed. If you wish to take 2 weapons from the armory, you must discard your own magical sword. So, there is a choice of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 possible options to choose 2 from. They are Havgar's Mace, the Paladin's Lance, the Crossbow of Shamar the Shield Maiden, the Axe of Lothar of Krun, the Griffin Shield, the Dwarf Breastplate, the Helmet of Ventark, and some iron gauntlets. So, I'm not going to take any of the weapons because I don't have the special skill that makes me good with other weapons. Similarly, I don't have a special skill that makes me good with shooting weapons, so that's the crossbow out as well. So, with the mace, the lance, the crossbow, and the axe gone, we're now left with the shield, the breastplate, the helmet, and the gauntlets. I'm going to take the shield, I think, and the helmet. Shields are all often useful, and I like the idea of protecting my precious bonds. So let's have a look at the shield. Wern tells you that the Griffin Shield used to be granted to knights for acts of extreme loyalty and bravery. Whenever you are carrying the shield in battle, you may reduce an enemy's attack strength by 1. Oh, that's cool. So that gives me an effective skill of 11, which is actually pretty good. Let's have a look at the Helmet of Ventark. This splendid helmet is surmounted by a polished eagle with wings outstretched at its crest. It was taken at the sacking of Ventark during the Second Ruddlestone War in 1805, and time has not yet tarnished it. You can note down that date, 1805. I foresee a strong possibility that that might become relevant. Choosing your gear for the adventure from this list of really quite fancy sounding weapons and armour is a really cool feature. I don't know why I can only take two bits from it given the seriousness of the mission. I get only wanting to carry like an additional weapon, but I feel as though a shield, a breastplate, a helmet and some gauntlets, I could take all of those quite easily. One of those things that just slightly bugs me about a lot of game books that do something similar, where you're told that this is the most dangerous mission that anyone has ever gone on in the entire history of the world, and we're only going to let you take a couple of magic items with you so that the other side has a sporting chance. But I will say that choosing stuff from a list of fancy sounding weapons and armour does make a nice change from buying rope and lanterns and whatnot from a market stall. Armed and ready for your quest, you hurry to the stables where you find that Firemane has already been saddled and is eager to be on his way. You are handed a backpack, and inside it you find enough provisions for 5 meals. Hooray! Provisions. A lantern and a tinderbox and a purse containing 20 gold pieces. There's also a flask marked with the Rune of Healing, which contains some of Aranidus's restorative potion. There is enough here for 2 tots, and each tot will restore your stamina to its initial level. That is very handy, because I suspect I might be eating provisions just to illustrate the passage of time. Urging your trusty steed forward, you gallop through the main gates and leave the citadel, taking the main road south towards the town of Havelock, which lies 2 days' ride away. You pass through well-cultivated fields and pleasant hills. However, as you travel further away from the capital, you begin to see some of the results of the disruption in the kingdom. A distinct atmosphere of gloom is hanging over the hamlets and farmsteads, and you pass many beggars on the road. There is a sharp chill in the air as the month of close tightens its grip on the land, and you fear for those people whose crops have not been as plentiful as they might have hoped. It is early afternoon when you catch sight of a strange-looking procession coming towards you along the road. It seems to be composed of a motley crowd of peasants and farmers, but at their head are 3 bizarre figures. The first is tall and dressed in a long black habit. In one hand he holds a scythe, its blade gleaming dully. And beneath his hood you see that he is wearing a wolf skull mask. The next is of average height but is swathed in torn rags and bandages. As he trudges along the road he rings a bell, warning that he is unclean, a leper. The third figure is a gaunt woman, her almost skeletal body covered by a tattered cloak. It looks as though she has not eaten for weeks. So there's a picture of the fella dressed in black with the scythe and the skull mask, and the poor fella afflicted with leprosy, and the very skinny woman. Again, it's a really solid bit of work. There's a crowd of farming types behind them as well. Yeah, doesn't sort of leap out at me as being spectacularly brilliant art. But at the same time, it is perfectly reasonable. Yeah, it's a good choice as well, but it's an arresting image to choose to depict. The first man stops and raises his hand for the procession to halt. "What have we here?" he says. "I do believe it is a knight errant, or should I say an errant knight?" The crowd laugh at the leader's remark and begin to jeer you. "Enough!" he shouts. "This is the epoch of our damnation. While the common people starve, our blessed Templars live in splendour and plenty. We 3 are the prophets of doom come to save the people. The doom we prophesy shall be yours." At these words, the crowds cheer and several raise pitchforks and other improvised weapons ready to fulfil their leader's prophecy. Some are already beginning to edge around you. You're going to have to act fast to get out of this unpleasant situation. Then you try to ride through the mob, attack the prophets, or talk your way out. Well, the mob have an absolute point in that, yeah, I am living in splendour and plenty while people are starving. Honestly, I'm more on their side than mine. But we've got a job to do, and no one's going to survive if I don't do it. So I will try and ride through the mob, I think. Seems like the least violent of the available solutions. With a shout, you kick your heels into Firemane's flanks. The horse whinnies and leaps forward into the crowd. Driving your mount forward, you charge past the startled protesters. As you flee, however, you are struck by a pike and lose 2 stamina points. Stamina now 13. Soon you are well past the angry mob, but you acted dishonourably towards the starving people. Lose 1 honour point. So it's doing quite a good job here of making sure that most of the systems are introduced early doors. I'd actually kind of forgotten about honour, I'll be honest. So nice to have that reminder that that's a thing. Though weird to treat honour as a resource. But anyway, wasting no more time, you continue southwards. The afternoon winds on as you and Firemane head south. While you ride along undisturbed, you consider the different paths that you could take that may lead to success in your quest. The most direct form of action will be to make your way to Caer Skaal as quickly as possible. However, if you are going to have to face Belgaroth's Chaos Knights and Warriors, it may be wise to try and recruit your own small force as you proceed. Aranandus' words about the Forest of Lean also interest you. You know that the vast expanse of woodland is a mysterious place, protected by ancient elemental powers. Powers which may be able to help you in your quest. There is also another option open to you, to find the legendary elf spear Aelfgar. Stories about this mystical weapon predate the crusade against Chaos. Forged by the Elves of Lean centuries ago, it is rumoured to be imbued with the power of the gods themselves. Legends tell how it has been wielded many times against the forces of darkness and has saved the land from eternal night. To find Aelfgar would be a momentous undertaking, but could prove the way to victory. Night falls and you have tethered Firemane to a tree and settle down for the night in the shade of a copse just off the road. With a gentle breeze blowing through the leaves of the trees, you are soon lulled to sleep. I'll tell you one thing, for the purposes of this recording, we are going straight to Caer Skaal. Yep, when in doubt, go for the most obvious route possible. One of the joys of doing this podcast is that, in some ways, knowing that I'm probably not going to succeed on the recorded playthrough frees me to make silly or obviously foolish decisions. And that kind of brings in a little bit of role playing to it, because I can imagine that my knight is the sort of bluff, hardy and non too bright posho who's just simplest way, always the best, no messing about. We'll just go straight to Caer Skaal, beat up Belgaroth, job done, go home, tea and crumpets, it'll be fine. Anyway, if we've got the commune special skill, which we do, something interesting will happen. During the night, you wake up, sensing that all is not well. Hovering above you, you see a ghostly white hand clutching a dagger, the blade glinting in the moonlight, poised and ready to strike. What will you do to defend yourself? Will you use the banished spirit skill if you have it, or unsheath your weapon ready to fight? I feel as though this isn't actually a spirit, and trying to banish it is just going to get me stabbed. So I'm going to unsheath my weapon ready for a fight. I don't know why I think that, and it turns out that I'm entirely wrong about that. The assassin's dagger streaks towards you, intent on your destruction. However, as you will soon discover, the knife-wielding spectral hand is no ordinary opponent. As it has no body of any sort, the hand cannot be destroyed in combat, only fended off. If you win an attack round against the spirit, you will not do it any damage, but merely keep it at bay. While you are doing this, the assassin's dagger will try to stab you to death. So the assassin's dagger has a skill of 10 but no stamina. You are not going to be able to overcome this opponent through combat, so you'll have to try something else. If you win 2 consecutive attack rounds, or otherwise after 4 attack rounds, you will have worked yourself into a position from which you can try to escape. So we've got to win 2 attack rounds or survive for 4. So with that in mind, I'm going to roll some dice. I have survived for 4 attack rounds and the assassin's dagger hit me twice. I hit it once and we drew once. But anyway, I've worked myself into a position to try to escape with my whopping stamina of 9. So the choices are, do we want to run into the copse to hide from it or leap onto Firemane's back and flee on horseback? I will leap onto Firemane's back and flee on horseback. Don't know how fast floating hands can travel. As you leap into the saddle, your ghostly attacker makes a final lunge at you. Test your skill. My skill is 10. 7, I am fine. Only after you have put several hours of hard riding between you and the spirit assassin do you stop again for what remains of the night. Add 1 day to the time elapsed and write down the word Regad on your adventure sheet. At dawn, you are on your way again. Regad being dagger backwards. It is mid-morning when you enter a pleasant valley at the bottom of which nestles the settlement of Wenderford. To the west lies an area of woodland, while on the distant horizon you can make out the dark edge of the Forest of Lean. The road on which you are travelling runs on southwards, out of the village to Havelock. Do you feel you may glean information here that could be of use to you on your quest? For a start, you know that the reclusive sage Herluin lives not far from the village. Do you want to try and find out more here in Wenderford, or as time is precious, will you ride straight through? Well, we've come to the conclusion that we're playing a very straightforward bluff knight, and he's going to take the view that time is precious, we will ride straight through. Firemane carries you southwards across many kilometres of bleak moorland in the direction of Havelock. After you have been travelling for several hours, you catch sight of a horse and rider galloping along a track that runs from the east parallel to the edge of the dark forest that is still a long way off in the distance. It looks as though the horseman's course will intercept yours if you continue at your present speed. Are you happy to meet the rider, or would you rather spur Firemane into a gallop? To avoid the stranger, I will see who this person is. As the horseman approaches, you see that he is wearing the livery of the Lord of Cleve Manor. When he is within earshot, he reins in his horse and calls out to you. I have been sent by my lord to offer you the hospitality of Cleve Manor and to request your aid, he says. My lord has heard of your quest and thought that you would appreciate a more restful night. There is also a more serious matter for which we would be most grateful for your help. The tenants on the manor's lands are being terrorized by a rogue boar from the forest. Our best soldiers have tried to kill it, but all have failed. Some say that the beast is enchanted and cannot be slain. Will you help us? A night in a bed would certainly be very refreshing. And you have pledged to keep order in the kingdom. However, such an expedition will take up valuable time. Will you go with a messenger to Cleve Manor, or will you press on and try and reach Havelock before nightfall? We will press on. It's a big pig. If you can't deal with a big pig, you don't deserve to be Lord of Cleve Manor, quite honestly. You are within sight of the walls of Havelock when dusk is falling. Riding on in the fast-falling light, you pass a copse of trees at the edge of the road. Suddenly, a dark shape drops out of the branches of one tree as you pass under it. Test your luck. 8, that is a fail. It's kind of weird to be just constantly failing luck tests right at the start of the adventure. A pair of feet slam into your chest, knocking you from the saddle, and you land awkwardly on the road with your assailant atop you. Lose 2 stamina points. Stamina now 7. Might be time to take a glug of that potion once I'm done with this. For a moment you wrestle with the man before you manage to throw him off. Quickly, you jump to your feet and draw your weapon as 2 more figures emerge from the copse holding cudgels. The first attacker pulls a long knife from his tunic and advances towards you. "We're gonna slit your throat, Templar," he spits. "And then the murderers are upon you. You must fight them all at the same time." This could be problematic. So they are literally just called murderers. First murderer, second murderer, and third murderer, which is, kind of a cool name. The first murderer, skill 7, stamina 6. The second, skill 6, stamina 8. And the third, skill 7, stamina 7. So, yeah, we're going to take a look at this. This could be quite a challenging fight. And it might be time to fire up the old battle simulator to get an idea of just how dangerous it actually is once I've done my own fighting. But anyway, I'm going to roll some dice. I have defeated the murderers, and happily I lost no stamina. I'm going to drink my first tot of stamina potion to return my stamina to 18. I've also crunched a few numbers, and my battle simulator suggests that somewhere around 5 stamina would be the average you would lose with the effective skill of 11 that I've got over the course of that fight. So not particularly dangerous at my skill level. However, once you drop even a point of skill to 10, you're looking at losing about 8 points of stamina, which is a big chunk of your starting health. And it grows rapidly from there. So if you've got, you're looking at 13 points of stamina, roughly, to lose from a skill of 9, 21 from a skill of 8, and 36 from a skill of 7. So even though the maximum skill of your opponents was 7, it is actually genuinely quite a tough fight. Yeah, the battle simulator really earning its bread there, because that's an interesting one to simulate. Anyway, as soon as you have dispatched 2 of your opponents, turn to the next section. While you have been dealing with 2 of your opponents, the third murderer attempts to make his escape. You will have to stop the rogue. If you have a crossbow, you may use it now. If you are successful in its use, turn to one section. If you fail, or if you do not have a crossbow or do not wish to use it, which is very much the situation we find ourselves in, you will have to pursue the felon on Firemane. As the man flees, he drops several spiked metal balls in Firemane's path. Firemane shies and rears up to avoid galloping into the deadly caltrops. Do you have the ride special skill? I do not, so I must test my skill. Goodness, it's not a luck test, because that would have been very dicey, but a skill test should be fine. And with a roll of 5 and a skill of 10, I am absolutely fine. Really enjoying the encounters in this. You manage to keep your seat in the saddle and guide your steed round the hazard. You soon catch up with the desperate man and cut him down easily. Kind of thought I might be trying to interrogate him, find out who he's working for, but I guess it doesn't really matter. Not short on enemies. Hurriedly, you search the man's body. However, you find nothing but a small charm carved out of dark wood in the shape of a raven, a bird of ill omen. On the bodies of the other 2 murderers, you find 3 gold pieces. As night has fallen, you decide that it is time to head for Havelock. So we're now up to 23 gold. And we've got an unlucky raven charm. Definitely does seem to be an unlucky charm, given the way that life turned out for the owner. You find that the gates of Havelock have been securely shut for the night. However, as soon as the guard sees that it is an elite Templar Knight of Telak who seeks entry into the town, he hurries down and unbars the gate, letting you into Havelock. You find a room and a hot meal for the night at a cost of 3 gold pieces at the Red Herring, a large inn popular among the adventuring fraternity. Having eaten, you retire for the night. As you are preparing for sleep, through your window, you suddenly catch sight of a blazing ball of light shooting across the blackened sky, a fiery trail trailing behind it. The comet soars onwards until it disappears over the hills on the distant horizon. It is a well-known fact that a comet is a sign of impending disaster, and you have just witnessed such a portent. It is some time before sleep eventually overcomes you. Lovely medieval details. He's very good at throwing in the medieval details. And something that marks out Jonathan Green's books is a real attention to creating situations and sort of set dressing, if you like, that really make this feel more like medieval England than many fantasy worlds. You rise early, feeling refreshed after an untroubled night's rest. Restore up to 2 points of stamina and add 1 day to the time elapsed. So stamina already maximum because I quaffed some potion, but time elapsed now 2 days. Having left the Red Herring, you get ready to explore the town. Havelock is not a large town, but as time is pressing, you do not want to spend too long here. In Havelock, you should be able to find some useful equipment you may need later in your quest. And surely here would be a good place to try and recruit a small army with which to oppose Belgoroth's forces. If that's what you intend to do, do you want to visit the markets, or do you want to try and recruit an army? As I said at the start, I have had all the markets I could ever want in fighting fantasy books, so I'm going to try and recruit an army instead. Having made a few discreet inquiries, eventually you find yourself outside the impressive headquarters of the Mercenaries Guild, the best place to recruit an army. The tall stone building itself looks like a small fortress, the entrance being barred by a portcullis. After you have rung the bell next to the door, a hunchback figure appears at the window above the portcullis and asks you your business. You explain that you desire to assemble an army of brave fighters and are soon standing before Guildmaster Nazra Strawn and a crowd of rough-looking, battle-scarred ruffians. "So you want to hire an army, but you haven't got the money to pay us?" Strawn booms. The mercenaries burst into raucous laughter. "But your bravery and heroism would go down in legend," you say. "This is no petty dispute between rival lords, but a battle against the very forces of evil and chaos, the outcome of which will determine the fate of the kingdom, if not the whole of the old world itself. Think of the honour and prestige. Such rewards are worth far more than gold." And the mercenaries are silent. After a moment's thought, Strawn speaks again. "You still don't understand why the warriors of Telak aren't prepared themselves, but that's not my concern." "No, it's a fair question. It's an enormously fair question. We don't have time to recruit an army. Let's go and recruit an army." Baffling.
"All right, we'll join your crusade if you can prove your own skill as a warrior. You must best our champion in combat.
Will you agree to these terms and fight, or will you leave the Mercenaries Guild and Havelock itself and continue on your quest?" "I will agree to the terms and do a bit of a fight." As you are led along the dark stone corridors of the guild, you pass several doors behind which you can hear the sounds of soldiers practicing their fighting skills. Strawn leads you into a circular torchlit room, in the centre of which is a pit several metres deep. The mercenaries crowd into the room as you are directed down a flight of steps into the brawl pit. A cheer goes up from the spectators as a portcullis on the far side of the pit rises and the mercenary champion enters the arena. The man looks as tall as an ogre and is built like an ox, or indeed like an ogre. The only armour he wears are leather crossbelts looped over his muscular torso and a spiked helmet which hides his face. He is armed with a vicious-looking sword with a jagged blade and a long knife. Strawn raises his hands and a hush descends over the mob.
"Well, this is not a fight to the death," he announces. "The winner shall be the first to knock the other to the ground. Are the combatants ready?"
You and the mercenary nod in reply.
"Well, then let the trial by combat commence."
With an animal roar, the champion charges at you across the pit while his fellows shout his name in encouragement. So the mercenary champion has a skill of 10 and a stamina of 11, and there is a quite neat picture of the mercenary champion. Not much of an action shot, he's just sort of standing there. I feel it would have been more exciting if he'd been caught lunging towards the viewer. But again, perfectly solid bit of work. It is a very spiky helmet. Big old rhino spike right in the middle. So he's got a skill of 10 and a stamina of 11. If he wins an attack round, we roll one die. On a roll of 1 to 3, his Jagged Blade does the usual 2 points of stamina. On a 4 to 6, it does 3. If you roll a double 6 while calculating your attack strength, and you win that attack round, your blow hits your opponent with such force that you knock him to the ground. If the mercenary's attack strength is ever 22, then something happens. So if he rolls a double 6, basically. And if you reduce the mercenary's stamina to 4, or he reduces your stamina to 4, then something happens to end the fight as well. So with those slightly complicated rules in mind, I'm going to roll some dice. Okay, I have rolled a double 6 for my attack strength and won that attack round. And I have knocked him to the ground. Before I did that, he has dealt 6 points of damage to me, reducing my stamina to 12. You stand with your sword poised mere centimetres from the champion's throat and claim victory as yours. Oh, very well, says Stron. I would trust such a warrior as you to lead my men into battle. I only ask that you give us a little time to ready ourselves for such an important campaign. You agree to meet Stron and his mercenary band at the deserted outpost of Harnwatch in one day's time. Write the word Ekroth, or Force Backwards, on your adventure sheet. Secure in the knowledge that you at least will have others fighting for you against the Dreadlord's forces, you prepare to leave Havelock. Leading Firemane towards the south gate, you pass through a square where a crowd of people seem to be enjoying some spectacle or other. As you get closer, you see that a crude stage has been set up in the square, and over this is stretched a moth-eaten banner with the words Oddfellow's Mummers painted across it. Occasional gasps of amazement and peals of laughter rise from the crowd as they watch the show being put on by the travelling players. Do you want to pause for a moment to watch the mummers, or do you prefer to make for the south gate? Oh, I'm tempted to watch the mummers because I'm wondering whether this is going to be a nice little reference to the sort of mystery plays that were popular in the Middle Ages. But I must stick to the characterisation I have come up with. There'll be plenty of time on subsequent playthroughs to examine the mummers, so I'm just going to make for the south gate. You are within sight of the south gate when you find the way temporarily blocked by a procession of clerics passing along the street. The priests are wearing long green robes and are chanting in a low monotone. As you survey the scene before you, you overhear a merchant talking to a servant. The clerics of Lean are a charitable priesthood who do much to help the poor and needy of this town, but they're also a very secretive group. Only the initiated may enter their temple. If you have either or both of the words Relim or Nrot written on your adventure sheet, turn to one section. If you haven't, which I haven't, we turn to another. I don't know why he's decided that all of the keywords are going to be just words backwards, but yeah, it's a really weird choice to have made. Remounting your trusty steed, you make your way through the south gate out of Havelock. Two roads lead away from Havelock. The westerly road eventually has a branch leading south to the village of Enox. You know that the dwarf blacksmith Torin Silverblade has his forge near Enox. In his youth, Torin was a warrior of Telak, but now he is renowned for the quality of the armour he makes, which some say has magical properties. He could well provide you with magical defence against the blows of your enemies. However, to find his forge would mean making a long detour to the village of Enox. Do you have time to make such a journey? Nope, I don't. I will head directly south towards Caer Skarl, skirting the Forest of Lean. The ride south is uneventful since the road passes through cultivated fields, then on to barren moorland. To the east lies the sprawling expanse of ancient woodland that is so bound up in legend. It is said that objects made from wood taken from the trees retain some of the elemental magical energies of the forest, and that elves, as well as stranger creatures, dwell within its depths, keeping it from harm. The road gradually swings towards the trees and you enter a narrow wooded stretch. Suddenly, a rope that was spanning the road is jerked up from under the cover of leaves on the ground and is pulled taut. You are galloping straight towards it. Test your skill, adding 2 to the dice roll if you do not have the ride special skill. So, I roll an 11, which would have been a fail anyway. But with adding 2, that gives me 13, which is considerably above my skill of 10. Your reactions are too slow, and you are caught by the rope, throwing you backwards off your mount. You hit the road painfully on your back, lose 3 stamina points and 1 skill point, and sit up dazed. So, skill now 9, that's not good. And stamina now also 9. You are immediately surrounded by a band of ruffians dressed in rough clothes of brown and green. They are armed with an assortment of weapons ranging from staves to daggers, and they look a motley bunch. There is a one-eyed cutthroat, a woman wearing metal-studded leather armour, a renegade monk, and their leader, a tall man whose face is hidden by a hood. "A Templar, eh?" he says in a refined accent. "Rich pickings, indeed." And with that, the outlaws attack. If you are still mounted, you may fight the outlaws one at a time and add 1 to your attack strength for the duration of a battle. If you have been unhorsed, you must fight all of your opponents simultaneously. So a little Robin Hood reference here. There are 4 outlaws, a cutthroat, a bandit, a renegade monk, and a wolf's head. And the cutthroat has a skill of 6, a stamina of 5. The bandit has a skill of 7, a stamina of 6. The renegade monk a skill of 6, a stamina of 7. And the wolf's head a skill of 8 and a stamina of 7. So this is going to be an absolute pain in the backside to run, but run it I shall. I'm going to roll some dice. I have defeated the robber band, and I was reduced to 2 stamina points in doing so. I've run the numbers in my battle simulator and discovered that losing 10 stamina actually slightly better than the expected outcome of losing 12.5 stamina points for a fighter with an effective skill of 10. It's a tough fight. It's a really tough fight. But yeah, came through it by the very skin of my teeth, so that's quite exciting. You search the outlaw bodies and find a total of 8 gold pieces and a silver locket. So 26 gold and a silver locket. You may take any of their weapons if you wish to, remembering the restriction on the number you can carry or use at any one time. There's a quarterstaff, a dagger, and 2 swords, none of which is magical. I will take a sword. Good to have a spare. When you are finished here, you set off south again with Firemane. Eventually, you rejoin the main road, heading south, and by late afternoon you come in sight of the edge of the Great Forest of Lean. Not far along the track, you reach the village of Asart, built in a huge clearing inside the border of the forest. As you ride into the village, you see a group of people in fierce debate. "But if we don't do something, we're as good as dead," a young, scholarly-looking man is saying desperately. "But what can we do?" a burly forester replies. "There are too many of them, and more come each night. There are those who'd be willing to fight if we had a strong leader to take us into battle."
"Failing that, we need someone who'd be prepared to go along there and kill the necromancer," an old woman declares.
She suddenly catches sight of you and adds,
"Someone like a Templar."
You ask the group what the problem is, and the old wise woman tells you about the necromancer and the ghost village.
"Not far from here, to the west, lies what is left of the village of Merton. It's been deserted for years, and most of it's in ruins now. But no one's ever been there because of the stories. A necromancer lies buried there, and people do say that the place is haunted. But now, it looks like the tales are true at last. For Moonsday night, the dead of Merton rose from their graves and attacked our village, carrying off 3 people. They've been back every night since, their number increasing all the time, so we have to lock ourselves in our homes. 4 men were taken last night. It seems as if the necromancer is back, and he's building himself an army of the undead."
"Certainly does, but you cannot help thinking that Belgoroth's corruption and chaos may be the source of the problem."
"Everyone in Asart's afraid," the woman continues, "and no one dares go to Merton itself, not even during the day. Will you help us?"
I don't want to lose any more honour, so I guess I'm going to have to help the people of Merton. The villagers cheer at your announcement. You must act tonight so as to save time and protect Asart from the cursed twilight existence of the undead. Do you have the battle tactics special skill, and do you want to organise the villagers into a small fighting force? I do not, and I don't. I will have to do this one on my lonesome, I think. The people of Asart bolt their doors and barricade themselves inside their homes as you set off alone on Firemane going west towards Merton. Definitely drinking the stamina potion. Returning my stamina to 18. Dusk is falling as you reach the derelict ruins lying under a thick pall of mist. The air is heavy with the smell of death, and you can hear the tolling of a bell. Suddenly, a great crowd appears out of the mist, blocking the way to Merton. The undead villagers stumble towards you, moaning and waving farm tools threateningly in your direction. You have no choice but to charge these undead ranks in an attempt to break through their lines. Roll two dice to see how many of the undead strike you. If you have the Holy Strike special skill, which I do, you may reduce this number by 2. You can also do that if you have a lance. For every strike, you lose 2 stamina. So I get 7, which is 5 strikes, reducing me to 8 stamina. That's not good. Good job I drank that potion. If you survive running this gauntlet, the undead ignore you and instead make for Asart, leaving you to go after the necromancer. An unnatural stillness hangs over Merton and the whole village seems deserted. What could have happened here all those years ago? Much of it is ruins with only a few stone buildings still standing, enveloped in fog. These include the Elder's Meeting House to the northeast, the village lockup to the southeast, and a tall bell tower, which has remained totally intact, to the north. The tolling comes from the bell tower, and a cloud of bats is flitting about its eaves. You can also see an abandoned graveyard lying to the west on the far side of the village. Where will you begin your search for the necromancer? Well, if we're going by the Hobbit, the necromancer will live in a tower, so I'm going to go for the bell tower. You enter the bell tower through a small door at its base and climb a spiral stone staircase to the top. Here you find a square room with an arched opening in each wall. A large iron bell is swinging on its frame in the centre of the chamber, tolling somberly. The only occupants of the belfry are several large bats hanging upside down from the rafters. Do you want to try and stop the bell tolling, or would you rather leave the tower and search elsewhere? I will try and stop the bell tolling, please. You have no trouble silencing the bell. You smash it to pieces with your weapon. By doing so, you have slightly weakened the evil power at work here. From now on, while you are in Merton, you may reduce the skill of any undead creature you have to confront by 1 point. Regain 1 luck point for this good fortune. Much needed luck point, taking my luck up to 6. However, something else is less happy at your stopping the death knell. One of the bats drops from its roost and, exposing 2 elongated fangs, attacks you. You are going to have to kill the vampire bat before you can leave the tower. So the vampire bat has a skill of 7 and a stamina of 6. Should be a cakewalk. I'm going to roll some dice. I have defeated the vampire bat. I took no damage. If you defeat the bloodthirsty guardian of the belfry, you notice a battered but usable lantern standing at one corner of the room. If you do not have a lantern, you may take this one. Then you descend the tower safely and leave it to search elsewhere. So let's go to the graveyard. Graveyard seems like a sensible place to look for a necromancer. Of course, where else would you look for the deceased necromancer but the graveyard? Many of the graves are open, but the cemetery is dominated by a grim-looking sepulchre that is decorated with carvings of skeletons and has the image of a huge skull on its granite doors. These doors stand open, revealing a flight of stone steps that lead down into the gloom of the mausoleum. Of course, you would not dream of descending into the darkness without some means of lighting your way, would you? If you do not own a lantern, you must leave the graveyard to search for one. I do have a lantern. In the mausoleum, you sense, is where you will find the necromancer. So, do we want to go straight down? Or examine some of the opened graves first. No, we will go straight down. You take one step towards the macabre edifice, and there, directly in front of you, stands a terrifying spectre. The apparition makes a grasp for you with decayed hands reaching from under its burial shroud, while its jaw drops open and lets out a rasping howl, no doubt warning others in the tomb of your presence. You must deal with the haunt swiftly. Do you have the banish special skill? I do. Without even thinking, you make the appropriate gestures and utter the words to dismiss the haunt. The evil guardian spirit screams in pain as it is sucked into the earth at your feet. Excellent. Banishing spirit seems to be really, really good. The flickering light of your lantern casts eerie shadows on the morbid carvings that adorn the walls of the sepulchre when you descend into its depths. Do you have the commune special skill? I do. The carvings on the walls around you suddenly distort and transform into hundreds of screaming human faces. Their anguished features fill your vision, and their wailing all but deafens you. These are the poor souls held in perpetual torment by the necromancer's dark powers. Then everything is as it should be again. However, you are disturbed by this experience. While you remain in the sepulchre, you must reduce your skill by one. Not great, but it's really, really cool seeing that the skills will sometimes not help, may actually sometimes be a hindrance. I love that sort of thing as well. Yeah, really, really nice bit of design. Ability to commune with spirits and magical energies, sometimes a weakness as well as a strength. A passage leads from the steps into a square chamber which has the same ornamentation as the exterior of the sepulchre. Three archways lead further into the tomb. Do you have the arcane lore special skill? I do not. So which way will I go? South, west or north? I guess I've come in from the east. So I'm facing west. So south is the closest to a left turn that is available to me, so I will go south. Entering a chamber at the end of the tunnel, you behold a scene of destruction and desecration. The crypt is full of stone coffins, but every single one has been broken open and the bodies inside are missing. Every one, that is, except for a sarcophagus resting on a plinth at the end of the chamber. Do you want to open and search this last coffin? Yes, I do. Hopefully it's got a necromancer within it. You push against the heavy stone lid and with a grating noise it slides open. Lying in the sarcophagus is what remains of a tall man. Draped over his skeleton is the uniform of a knight bearing the insignia of the Golden Dragon. An unpleasant grey mould covers the bones. When you opened the coffin, a cloud of spores flew into the air. You cannot avoid inhaling a lungful and you start coughing violently. The spores of the poisonous mould affect your breathing and you must lose 3 stamina points. Stamina now 5. If you have the word Urglap, Urgalp, if you have the word Urgalp written on your adventure sheet, you must lose 6 stamina points and 1 skill point instead because of the leper's wasting disease is aggravated by the spore cloud. Fortunately, I do not currently have leprosy. There is a picture of the knight in the tomb, and I can see that the tomb has got some carvings on it. It's a nice picture of the knight, by the way. I really like it, actually. And the tomb has got some words written on it in an unknown script. So maybe it's somewhere there's a clue to what that script means. I suspect it's probably either warning me off or telling me to take the ring, because the knight's weapons of war have long since rusted and are of no use to you. However, on one bony finger you notice a gold ring inscribed with a picture of a shield. Do you want to take the ring at the risk of releasing another cloud of spores, or leave the crypt and search elsewhere? I will take the ring, I think. Carefully, you reach into the coffin and slide the ring from the knight's finger. Test your skill. So my skill is currently 8. So that's a fail. If you fail, you knock the body while removing the ring and a second spore cloud is released. Lose 2 stamina points. Stamina now 3. And I can add the shield ring to my possessions. I have been recording for, I think, long enough at this point. I'm going to pause the recording there while my character scarfs down provisions frantically to try and get his stamina back up to something faintly useful. But I don't think I'm on the edge of death. I've got 5 provisions, so I can easily get my stamina back up to 18. So I think the adventure will probably continue for a little while yet, which is cool. But I've hit the point, I think, where I need to pause the recording or this will just go on forever. So I will continue playing on my own time and almost certainly fail because I've been ignoring an awful lot of prompts to explore. But that's fine. That's fine. As I said earlier, it's really nice to get the opportunity to play a book in a slightly dumb way, knowing that it's almost certainly not going to be the successful playthrough. So I actually quite enjoyed that as a different way of approaching the book. I'm going to go away, finish this run, finish playing it on my own time, and we'll be back for you in just a few moments with some closing remarks. Tatty bye. For those keeping track at home, my adventure ended, as is traditional, almost immediately after ending the recording. I glanced in another room in the crypt, then got stuck in front of the necromancer's lair, where I didn't know the secret formula for opening it. Giving it up as a bad job, I wandered out and was partially eaten by a horde of zombies, and brought back to life as one of the zombies, ready to partially eat the next person who was foolish enough to come across the graveyard. Turns out I really should have been exploring my surroundings more than I actually did. Who could have foreseen that being an issue? I did assume that this one would be hard, and honestly, the playthrough lulled me into a bit of a false sense of security. Obviously, I failed, but I felt like I'd got a decent distance into the book, and that was with ignoring the various proffered side quests. I was feeling good about making a second attempt. Those good feelings evaporated astonishingly quickly. This book is hard as nails. It feels like it might be a competitor for being the hardest book in the entire series. It combines brutally difficult fights, dice rolls or death, and a laundry list of necessary items. It seemed more generous only because the eccentric route I took happened to dodge some of the most dangerous bits by sheer good luck. It's an absolute swine to finish on every conceivable level. That difficulty is something that I'm going to explore in detail because it's honestly impressive how every possible vector for making it hard is explored. But before we get into specifics of it, I want to look at the overall vibe. Structurally, this is actually fairly linear and easy to grasp. That is one of the few concessions that this book actually makes. You are a Templar with magical powers, travelling south towards the source of a monstrous evil that is blighting the land. There's a bunch of locations that hang off an otherwise straight path, like branches of a tree. You can climb out to explore those branches, but once you've done that, you'll be back on the main trunk of the adventure. This isn't the worst structure by any means, and in some ways it makes exploring easier, which is handy in a very challenging book. It does tend to mean that there's not a great deal of scope for taking wildly different paths on repeated playthroughs, though. As you get closer to the source of the evil, you'll find the landscape changing and becoming more twisted, and the denizens becoming ever more dangerous. If that sounds oddly like Dead of Night, then congratulations, yes, it does. That's not even really a criticism. Although I think Dead of Night is a better book, there's honestly nothing wrong with borrowing the basic structure for a new work. And although there's clearly some overlap in terms of premise, structure, and core design, Knights of Doom does feel pretty different in tone. Dead of Night had a lot of pulpy horror elements to it, while Knights of Doom feels a lot more like a traditional fantasy with a strong dollop of historical inspiration. Whether it's feasts as a form of hospitality, travelling mummers, flagellant cults, or Robin Hood-inspired outlaws, there's a very powerful feeling that this is fantasy that's been grounded in British history and folklore, right down to the constant looming presence of the forest, and I like that very much. Taken independently, the various different locations generally feel nicely designed and they are full of atmosphere. We saw the deserted village of the undead, which had that delightful addition of the tolling death knell you can stop. The thing where you then have to remember to reduce the skill of the monsters by one on top of whatever other mods you have in play is a little bit clunky, but it's still a neat effect. There's also a chance to go out hunting for a troublesome boar, which is very medieval, but also the boar, it turns out, is just a big pig. It's only got a skill of 8. Sort out your own big pig, mate. It's honestly not that hard. There's some evil clerics who worship a messed up plant elemental that I enjoyed, which is also tied to a fun little subplot with the mummers who we saw in the background in the playthrough. And that area basically has you fight a pantomime horse, although it's pretending to be a fire-breathing pantomime dragon in this case. I've got a place in my heart for any book that lets you beat up a pantomime horse, quite honestly. That's just a bucket list item I didn't know I had. You can also play an entire board game at one point, and that's a fun thing to include, though thankfully it's not on the actually required route, because having to repeatedly play an entire board game as part of your adventure would become a massive pain in the backside very quickly. But as this cool look at this, here's a random thing, it's very, very neat. Perhaps my favourite encounter comes towards the end when you enter the woods for the final time and encounter the mysterious wood elementals who take you prisoner and then judge you for how your actions have harmed or helped the woodland realm. They only care about the forest, they have no interest in the wider battle of law and chaos. And it's realised with a neat mechanic where you tot up all the ways in which you've blundered about the forest during your adventure and try and roll under that total to avoid the judgment of their stern and unforgiving king. It's a brilliant moment because it ties together a bunch of things that you've done earlier and makes you think about your prior actions in a new way. This is followed by a moderately decent battle sequence that I think would have made a fine climax to the book, and a slightly disappointing villain's castle which feels extremely off the peg. Arguably, I think the best finale would have been to go straight to a battle in the forest. That would have been different and the perfect way to tie everything together and give it a freshness that otherwise the finale really lacks, being just another throwdown with a big magic evil dude. Well, if the core encounters and locations are all pretty fun, what about the mechanics? Mechanically speaking, there's nothing here that doesn't formally work, and the additional honor stats, your skills, and the time tracker are all appropriately impactful in terms of their effect on the adventure. However, there's issues with all three, and they all tie into the exceptionally high difficulty of this book, and they interact in ways that I genuinely think are quite interesting. Firstly, the skills are great on paper. I really like the idea of being able to choose how you build your character, and I think skills are the best way of creating differences between character at character generation. Generally much better than messing with stats, because skills are much easier to balance around. They're great because they provide a nice easy way to build in variation right from the start of the adventure. You can load in skill effects from the opening sections before you've found any items or keywords, and it's just a great way of providing multiple routes through your opening, which is the bit people are going to be playing most often. The skills in Knights of Doom are a lot of fun to select, but sadly, they aren't really a way to build a unique character. There's really only one viable set of skills to select, and so it just becomes another vector of making life difficult. It's another banana skin. You will definitely need to banish spirits, for example. It's strictly required to beat the game, but arcane lore is pushing pointless, and both commune and tracking will actually make life harder for you over the course of the whole adventure. Tracking is particularly bad because it will perversely make a required item more difficult to get, and that item is locked behind failing a skill roll. Locking items behind failed rolls is a terrible idea at the best of times. It's something I've covered at length in previous episodes, I don't need to rehearse it here, but compounding it by making one of your special skills that's supposed to be helpful into an actual hindrance is cruel and unusual, and honestly, in its own way, a perverted kind of genius. It's the sort of wrong
that I've never seen before, and that I think is oddly deserving of praise in a mad sort of way. And it is incredibly frustrating, though, because it's extremely obvious that Banished Spirits is awesome from a very early stage of the adventure, but you'll be playing a long time before you realise that if you take tracking, the game is unbeatable with a skill of 11, rather than being unbeatable with a skill of 12. Obviously, with a skill of 11 and without the tracking skill, you've got a whopping 1 in 36 chance to finish the book, assuming nothing else goes wrong at any point. Obviously, it gets easier to fail that necessary test if you've got a lower skill, but honestly, if your skill is less than 11, there's a significant chance you may die in some of the fights. There's a lot of fights in this book, many with high skill opponents. And while there's some fun ways to push the odds in your favour by picking up various bits of equipment, I don't think they're actually enough to get you over the winning line unless you've also got a decent starting skill. It's just an example of terrible design. Genuinely terrible design. At least there's only one skill check you have to fail. That's probably the nicest thing I can say. Honour and Time, meanwhile, present a whole different set of issues. Essentially, you need to ensure that you have enough honour to pass a check, which will give you access to one of the other required items. There's a fair few of them. However, doing side quests to gain honour will eat time, and if you take too much time, you'll also fail. Threading the needle of getting enough honour without running out of time is immensely challenging, and it's also extremely frustrating because you've got one mechanic demanding that you explore everywhere, and the other demanding that you really don't. While you can get some tremendous mileage out of balancing oppositional demands in games, it needs to be judged expertly if it's going to avoid becoming a nightmare, and for my money, this is a nightmare. Essentially, the gamebook is constantly reminding you that you need to move quickly, and then dangling tempting side quests in front of you, as if to say, I know you're on a mission where every second is precious, but do you fancy dinner and a show? By the way, if you don't take in this show, there's a good chance you'll die in 2 days' time anyway. It's a bit like if the secret to defeating the Terminator in the popular movie The Terminator was for Sarah Connor to stop running and start a handmade Christmas card business halfway through the movie. It's something where I think overall, unless you are a supremely skilled designer with a lot of time to playtest and workshop, you probably want to pick one approach or the other. And in the case of gamebooks, you probably want to go with encouraging people to explore, since that's kind of how gamebooks work. You don't really want to try and get people not to read your book. That seems like a bad plan. Honour and Time are an interesting example of both rules working more or less fine. Honour in particular, yeah, no issue with how it's implemented. Go off and do a bunch of good deeds, get your honour up. That's kind of cool. But when you combine honour with time, they're both just so unhelpful. Gaining and losing honour is broadly intuitive. The passage of time feels pretty realistic, but put them together and they suck. Not least because there's just so little wiggle room. One mistake on either front and you can basically kiss your playthrough goodbye. Of course, these are not the only sources of difficulty. You'll also need the aforementioned laundry list of items. There's a few puzzles, most of them fairly doable, but none of them what I would call a gimme. There's the many, many, many fights. Many of the fights are quite reasonable, but there's a lot of them which have special rules associated with them, which I usually quite like. But in this case, it just feels like another vector for making things more and more punishing. There's also a whole bunch of really difficult fights towards the end, which makes the finale feel like an absolute slog. The author does some very interesting things with fighting multiple enemies. In particular, one encounter where the enemies come at you two at a time, which means that you should refrain from killing the weakest fighter, which is a cool tactical decision to have to make. There's also a cool bit in the finale where the big boss can drain your honour as well as your health, and losing all of your honour will cause you to fall under his thrall, which is awesome. Or it would be if there was any mathematical way for your honour to be low enough that it would potentially run out before your stamina. I haven't been thoroughly exhaustive about all of the possible ways to get to the finale, but I think if you've made it that far, you'll almost certainly have a high enough honour that death from face stabbing will occur before your final corruption, which is a real shame. I think that's something that would have made the the finale and the final area as a whole really quite interesting, is if there was a bunch of ways for it to drain the honour that you've built up over the quest so far. At the end, that sudden inversion would have been really, really fresh feeling and really interesting. But as it is, it's still a really cool image in this final fight. And on top of all of this, add in a sprinkling of various stat tests that you need to pass or you'll die, and you've got the recipe for a book that I think is almost impossible to finish, honestly, and extremely difficult to finish even if you're cheating on some or all of the dice. Jonathan Green has admitted that it was not playtested as rigorously as he would have liked, and that's an issue with the times as much as anything else. It's important to remember that playtesting was much harder back in the day, and there were far fewer resources out there for designers. With that said, I do think some stuff is kind of obvious. You don't need to be a genius to know that monsters with a high skill are a problem if you're also going to need the player to fail a skill test. But I'm also aware that the money the authors were getting paid didn't exactly encourage a meticulous approach to design, nor indeed an iterative one. It's not just that Knights of Doom is brutally hard, it's also gruellingly long as a consequence of the linear design. And in terms of your final playthrough, you will be seeing at least 90% of the paragraphs in this book. Somehow, even though the house on Sentinel Hill that we featured last episode was 185 sections longer, it somehow didn't feel anything like as long as this, and that was also a genuinely hard book. I think the difference is that House on Sentinel Hill was very happy to throw in plenty of material that didn't either kill you or make you stronger, whereas it feels like every decision in Knights of Doom is doing one or the other, which makes it feel very, very dense. There's no bits that you feel like you can skip over. And it's a draining experience when you die and you realise that you need to start again and go through section after section after section in the exact same order for what feels like the 50th time. I think even if this book was considerably easier, it would still feel pretty long and exhausting to play through. Part of that is the book being rough, but part of it is also, I think, down to me, and I think I've reached a point where shorter form stories just appeal to me more. I think there's a sense of anxiety for me about having to go back to the start when books are really long and really hard. Some of the more modern books that have been long that haven't been that hard, and I've not minded the length so much there, particularly given that in the case of many of them, there's a real sense that you can kind of go where you want and do what you want and kind of pick and choose. And that means that there's always more to kind of discover on the next playthrough. So it's not that I'm totally against really long and detailed books. I think it's just really long linear books that are also rock hard. And it's certainly not something that really bothered me as a child. One, I'd have been happy to cheat, and two, I had nothing better to do with my time than play the same game book over and over again. And that's something that's definitely changed in me over time. I feel more drawn to shorter form entertainment in general, whereas as a younger person, I always wanted more of everything. And it's not even about being time poor. While I would never describe myself as lucky to be too unwell to hold down a proper job, it does theoretically mean that I have plenty of time on my hands. In my case, I think it's partly a function of the attention economy having gone sour. I don't want to have to watch every single Marvel movie and TV show just to feel like I'm suitably prepared for whatever the latest Disney Marvel content offering is. I don't want to watch 15 different spin-offs of The Walking Dead or read a dozen different comics in order to follow the meta-narrative. It's honestly refreshing when I play a video game that isn't trying to make a play to be the only hobby I actually have time to maintain. Now, media companies have always produced content in bulk. Look at how many episodes of Star Trek The Next Generation or Rawhide there are, for example. But they were designed to be consumed in almost any order you like, and there wasn't the same sense of needing to watch or read everything in the canon in order to enjoy the next one. There's over 200 Doc Savage novels that came out at a rate of one a month, but they're all slender adventure stories and you can read them in more or less any order you like. I've read three or four of them and I don't feel like I need to read any more, but honestly, if I saw one cheaply in a second-hand bookshop, I'd probably buy it knowing that I could read it on the train. It's mass-produced content that's designed to be picked up and put down at any point, and I think the thing that's changed is that there's a certain strand of modern content that is terrified that you might put it down and do just something else, and is absolutely invested in trying to make it as difficult as possible for you to do that. So I think hard and linear game books like Knights of Doom have been somewhat tainted by the cynicism of later content cycles, in which engagement is seen as more important than enjoyment. It doesn't matter if it's good so long as it takes a long time to consume and keeps you trapped in their ecosystem. As a lot of video games in particular are very much like that. And that is also a function of the media just having become so astronomically expensive to produce. And I should stress, I don't think that Knights of Doom is a cynical piece of work. I think the issues with its design are the result of a young writer who didn't have access to the support systems and the time needed to balance the book, and who was working on the basis that hard books were a good thing. But the design ends up accidentally reminding me of where we've ended up as a culture, a situation where our entertainment is often more interested in trapping us than enthralling us, and at times playing Knights of Doom made me feel a little bit trapped. And that's irritating, because while I think Knights of Doom is far too hard and feels too long, I don't think that either hard or long game books are a bad thing in themselves. It's just my brain that's been broken by an increasingly demented cultural landscape. There's loads of really cool encounters in Knights of Doom, and I think with a few different decisions, dropping the time to focus entirely on honour, sorting out one or two of the more egregiously difficult bits, changing it so that some of the items just make things easier rather than possible, I think you could have a really cool book here. It wouldn't be the most original thing in the world. You'd still be comparing it with Dead of Night, but there is the bones of a really fantastic game book here. And it's a shame that even with all of this kind of contextualization of why I think it came out like it did and why I think I've particularly badly responded to some elements of that, the overriding thing I come back to when I'm thinking of Knights of Doom is two things. It's too hard and it's too long. And that's a real shame. That is, however, all for this episode, which has been arguably too hard and too long as well. So there's some synchronicity there. I'll be back in February when we'll be looking at the next book in the Where of the Tiger series, which is always something of a treat. Don't forget, you can get in touch with me by email at hjdoomretrofun@gmail.com or by bothering me on bluesky at hjdoom. Thank you very much for listening. Take care, and I'll see you soon.